Well, hello, friends. Greg Kokel here, and welcome to Stand to Reason. And last week, Tim Barnett was in studio. He happened to be in town, so I dragged him in. And this week, our newest young gun, Jonathan Noyes, lingered too long after the staff meeting, and so I grabbed him and dragged him in. John, you're loaded for bear here. You got your Bible open already, man. You're ready to rock and roll here.
It's the sword. It's good to linger at Stand to Reason.
Yeah, well, you got Mark, too. You just opened it, huh? So
yeah.
We don't know what's going on there, so... But this isn't unusual for you to be on a radio show, because you've been doing radio for how long over here in Los Angeles area?
We're pushing almost 2 years.
Okay, and the program, tell us about it just
briefly. It's apologetics.com radio.
Uh-huh.
It's a call-in radio station from midnight to 1 a.m.
Oh, you got
on Saturday mornings.
You've got the premier time slot in there. Hope you don't have to preach.
It's the affordable time slot.
Oh, that's like Saturday morning, so you got Saturday.
Yeah.
Then, okay, because I remember... doing that. Did it used to be a two-hour show?
It used to be 2 hours, yeah.
Because every once in a while I would drive out there in the middle of the night and do a couple of hours with the boys up there. It's been a good show, and they've had different hosts at different times.
Yeah.
But there's a whole world that is awake at that time.
It's absolutely incredible, actually, how many people tune in and call. And I'll get calls from a Staten Island, and then the other way, the furthest is Hawaii, which actually helps them. You know, it's only 9 o'clock in the evening for them.
Oh, yeah. But what was amazing to me is that, like I said, there's a whole world. You think everybody's asleep except for some insomniacs, but there was a whole massive population who's upside down in terms of their schedules. They're up all night and they sleep during the day.
Yeah, absolutely. Anybody who's working the late shift, too, we get a lot of those.
Yeah.
It's a really fun show where we get to take callers, and it's kind of like here. It's like we'll address a topic and do the best that we can to answer people when they call.
Uh-huh.
It's fun.
Well, that's great. Let's see. Last week I had Tim on, and we got a call. We got to talking about this a little beforehand about Roman Catholics, rather Protestants, who were migrating to Roman Catholicism. I actually don't know that that's a very big trend, and it strikes me that the trend is quite the opposite. Roman Catholics, especially disaffected ones, or kind of what do you call marginal Roman Catholics, which is a lot of them, are finding something in Protestantism. And in my case, it was the gospel of grace that made that difference, because I was raised Catholic. And they're moving in this direction. I'm not trying to count heads necessarily, but there does seem to be a movement of some Protestants to Roman Catholicism. And I always wondered, we talked about this a little bit, what the appeal was. You said you had some friends.
I have a few that have started that trend, started going in that way, And I have one in particular who's a really good friend of mine, really great guy, and he just got confirmed into the Catholic Church.
So he had been a Protestant.
Oh, yeah.
See, now this is where I have a question, and the question I raised last time, and it seems to me the only question that matters in this kind of thing, in this movement from... I guess you could call it one Christian denomination to another Christian denomination, but there's a very significant shift in theological conviction going from a Protestant denomination to a Roman Catholic church. And so it seems to me somebody making that move would be deeply compelled by theological concerns, by theological convictions that amounted to the Protestant view of this important thing is not biblically accurate, and the Roman Catholic view is. And so there's a shift then to the Catholic Church in view of that changed understanding of biblical teaching. That's what it seems to me would be the motivating reason, but I have almost never seen that in people that have made the change, and it's mystifying to me. So I'm curious about what has been the rationale for those who you know who have made that shift.
Yeah, and I think that if you were to ask them, I'm going to try to portray them fairly, I think that they would say that the Catholic Church is appealing to them theologically, and mainly they would say that they don't think that the reasons for the Reformation ultimately were good enough for Luther, for example, to leave the church. He thinks that that those reasons were blown out of proportion because of the historical context that Luther was in. Mm-hmm. He thinks today the church, even the Catholic Church, is a little bit more understanding of differing opinions on certain things that Luther held, justification by faith, and not faith and works, right? And also,
that would be the way that Luther would have characterized. Are you saying that now Rome, Vatican II Rome, has a different view of that?
Now, I'm saying that I think that many of my friends who have left, the friends I have that have left Protestantism for Catholicism would say that today's church is a little bit more open to the idea that the two views can be held simultaneously. Now, I've pointed out just very briefly, but they can't both be true, right? One is either true or the other is true. They can't both be true at the same time.
Well, yeah, to be clear here with Rome, when it comes to justification, on my view, what Rome does is conflate justification and sanctification, which is why...
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah, no one could ever know that they're going to heaven because they don't know whether they've been sanctified enough by the grace of God is probably the way they'd put it, but I think it de facto comes down to works foundation, even though the language of grace is used to describe this. Salvation by grace... The grace is God gives you the grace to be more obedient, live a holier life, and as you live a holier and holier life, you're more and more justified, and hopefully when you die, you're justified enough to qualify for heaven.
Sure, yeah, and that's a scary place to be, I think, personally.
Well, it is, it seems to me, for a couple of reasons, but I mean, I'm trying to be fair with their view. I do think when you conflate justification with sanctification, it's hard to avoid a de facto works-based salvation. But going back to your friends making the change, saying, well, I don't think Luther was justified in leaving for the reasons he left, that's just another way of saying they believe that the Roman Catholic doctrines that are central to the whole salvation project are accurate the way they're communicating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Communicated so that then they wouldn't believe in justification as a finished work of Christ for the believer who trusts Christ and then therefore gets eternal life, John 17, and therefore can know that he has eternal life, 1 John chapter 5, but rather... And of course, I'm kind of making my case a little bit as we're moving along.
You're doing a good job,
but
too.
they would have to say that Luther was wrong and Rome was correct on their view of justification. So that's
right.
A theological
reason. Yeah, and for some reason, my friends that have made this move find that theological system not only more appealing, but true. And I'm not even 100% sure why, because I haven't had the deep conversations to happen. It's hard over the phone. But another appealing factor is the history of the church. Mm-hmm. Some of my friends would say that the Roman Catholic Church is a reflection, is the one true church, which leads to other theological issues like... can you not be a Roman Catholic and be saved?
Yeah.
And these are really hard conversations.
I mean, what about us? We're not Roman Catholics, but I guess they could say, well, you are, but you don't realize it.
But you don't realize it is one way to put it if you don't want to say the hard thing, which is no.
Yeah, but what they... And because if no, then if salvation is only in the Catholic Church, then Protestants are out, which they don't say that anymore. We're separated brethren, but we're not... We're still brethren.
Yeah.
Okay? And this is somewhat new development since the 60s in Vatican II.
And even with this newest pope, I think that there's a little bit more inclusivism as far as Protestants and Catholics coming together. And I think that's where my friends ultimately get confused.
Yeah.
Things like justification.
Right.
All of a sudden you have this system where, well, it can be faith alone, and that's fine. But it also can be faith plus works, and that's cool too. Uh-huh. These are two independent systems, but they both carry with it salvation.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of little bit more stuff with this new the new pope, that just seems to spin very wide of genuine Catholic or Protestant biblical doctrines. It's another issue. But I can see, by the way, some of the appeal from a if somebody likes the high church environment that you get. But that's aesthetic. That's not theological. I know the high church details are theologically grounded, but that's not what people are responding to. They're responding to the aesthetics sometimes.
Well, I think that that's true of also a lot of Protestants, too, when, in mainline evangelicalism and stuff. I think that oftentimes we find – you guys spoke to it last week when you're talking about worship music, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a different type of aesthetic, but it's aesthetics, right? I like the tune of a song or the way that it's I remember in my mind a radio top 50, but it might not be a good worship song.
Yeah.
And I think that that's the same thing with when people – I think that this generation, the millennials and younger, I think that they see an inauthenticity in the way church is done in the large, you know, traditional now evangelical.
Well, how would they?
And they like they like the structure and the history that Roman Catholicism brings during its mass.
I know, but what you mentioned inauthenticity, and you know, I was over the weekend. I had a conversation at a group meeting, largely Protestant, but there was a gal who chatted with me and identified herself as Roman Catholic, though she's kind of thinking about the issues a little bit. And so the question was, who's a real Christian kind of thing? And I was just making the distinction between people who hang around in church because this is what their family did and whatever. You come to the services, and a lot of Protestants like that too. But in my own circumstance as a Roman Catholic, we were obliged to go to Mass because this was a rule that, if violated, put you in jeopardy of going to hell. It was a mortal sin. Every Sunday, and also, what, 7 or 8 holy days of obligation, which made it a real bummer if Christmas was on a Saturday, because that was one of the holy days of obligation, and a week later was the circumcision, that was another one. So that means Saturday and Sunday, 2 weekends in a row, you had to go to church, which displays, and this wasn't unusual for people to feel this way, which displays a concern that we were pursuing church kind of as a bare necessity because it was required. You get in at the last minute and you leave as early as you can to get qualified. And it was interesting when I was talking to her, and not disparaging Catholics in general, but some who view this like that, like we did growing up, so there's not a real substantive conviction or faith. We weren't real Christians, even though we're part of a Christian group, so to speak. She piped in and she said, that's most of the Catholics that I know have this perspective. So back to the transparency or genuineness or whatever, or disingenuity, or you can have kind of shallow Protestant services that don't have the kind of depth and substance as maybe a liturgical church like the Roman Church. But then you have people in these services that have lots of history to them, but they don't want to be there. They come in at the last minute and they leave as soon as you possibly can get out and still get credit, you know. So that raises the question there of, is there really more authenticity in that kind of environment than, say, in a Protestant environment? I don't know.
Yeah, I probably agree with you. Like, the way that we'd answer that question, I'd say I'd answer it, no, there isn't. But there is for some. I can see the appeal. There is for some. You use the term appearance of depth and substance. And I think that what the Catholic Church does a really good job of doing is making it appear to certain people that we have depth and substance because we are the one. We are the true church, dating back to Peter. So with this church comes all the history of Christendom. And I think that that's really attractive to folks who have lost a sense of appeal in your typical evangelical type church.
Yeah. So many evangelicals have churches that go all the way back to the 70s, for goodness sake, you know. Wow, you know. Yeah. So,
and also, like, what's been really interesting to me is a lot of people, I don't think, understand. People who aren't Catholic or didn't grow up Catholic, I don't think they really know what Catholicism really is. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm part of a small
theologically
and substantially, like they've never, a lot of people have never even been to a real Catholic mass. I'm finding I have a small little church that I go to, and we're liturgical is what we say, and we recite the Apostles' Creed, for example. And I've had people come up and comment, they say, oh, well, the church service was great, people who visit us. church service was great, but it's awfully Catholic. And I'll ask him,
you're reciting
exactly. I'll ask him, well, why do you think it's Catholic? You know, and they'll say, oh, well, because you guys read, literally what they say is they'll say, because you read a lot of scripture and you recite the Apostles' Creed. And I'm like, but have you been to a Catholic Mass? Because neither one of those things happen in a Catholic Mass.
Yeah. Well, there is like the Gospel. There is a reading that's part of the calendar, but it's a very short reading from the Gospels and the Epistles.
Yeah.
So it's ironic, though, that they would say that since you go to a Reformed church.
Yes.
As I understand it, which is like very not Catholic.
No,
but,
definitely not.
You know, I can – the idea that that the environment of Catholic service has a certain sense of depth and appeal certainly resonates with me because I recall this is a number of years ago now. I would go on Good Friday. I would think, okay, I want to do something special on Good Friday. And so I thought, where could I go? And my own church now has a fabulous Good Friday service, okay? And it is very different than normal service. There's no preachment. There's a kind of a music and a video thing that's reflective, and you're kind of following along in this silent experience, and everybody leaves silently after the crucifixion part. So there's very meaningful. But prior to that, I had nothing, and I thought, it's Good Friday. Well, why don't I just go to a Catholic church? And so they do have a standard service, and that has some gravity to it. And I found this for myself now. Keep in mind, I'm not going because I have to go. Actually, I don't think anybody has to go, even a Catholic church on Good Friday. So most people that were there, certainly me, were there for a religious reflective experience. And that environment did help that for me. Now, since then, I not only do I have a church where I can have that kind of experience, but I would not do that again probably for other reasons. But it just demonstrates that there is this kind of appeal to the history and the kind of the weightiness of the atmosphere. I don't mean that pejoratively, just this kind of a religiously weightiness to the atmosphere that is appealing to somebody who is genuine and serious about their spiritual convictions as a Christian.
That's totally true. And coming from, like, when I was an atheist, Craig, before I was a believer, I pictured church as being a Catholic service. Like, my only experience, my only, I guess, the only thing that I had in my mind about Christianity, because I had never been to a evangelical church in my life. I had been to a Catholic church once or twice growing up. That's what I thought of when I thought of church. You know, and this all to be said also, I'd like to just make sure that my friends who have left Protestantism towards Catholicism, they have what they think are good reasons. They wouldn't just say, oh, because it feels good. They would say they would try to justify their position with what they're thoughtful men.
Theologically
and historical, theological and historical reasons. So they're not going there just because it feels nice or it's fulfilling a certain emotional need, which may or may not be true. They at least have an inclination of good ideas.
Well, that's great. I'm glad to hear that. Okay, I got to go to break here. We got a gazillion callers on board. Are you staying over because they're going to have you work some things on the boards there, answer phones or whatever? I don't know.
I'll do whatever Amy Hall tells me to do.
Okay, well, maybe we'll just keep you on for the rest of the hour here. We'll
answer
some calls. And then if Amy wants to put you to work next hour, we'll do that. All right. John Noyes here, Stand to Reason speaker, our youngest.
Well, not youngest.
I'm just
newest.
Pausing now. Newest.
Yeah. I'm an old man. I feel old.
Are you older than Tim?
Oh, yeah.
You're not older than Ellen.
No, thank God.
You're not older than me.
No, not yet.
Thank God. You will never be older than me.
No, I know this.
My sister is a year and 2 weeks older than me.
Yeah.
And she always reminds me, I will always be older than you. But I'll never catch up.
But with an eternal perspective, it doesn't matter.
Well, no, we will still have an age. So even in eternity, she will still be older than me, and I will still be older than
you. Yes, you will be.
John Noyes, Greg Kolkol on Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
You can take Stand to Reason with you through our mobile apps, available for free from the App Store or the Google Play Store. The Quick Reference app gives you short, easily accessible courses on our most popular topics like tactics, homosexuality in the Bible, morality, the story of reality, and many more. The Stand to Reason app has all our latest content available at your fingertips. You can listen to our podcasts, check the blog, and access timely and practical resources. They're free, so download the apps today on the App Store or the Google Play Store and start carrying Stand to Reason with you everywhere you go. If you enjoy our apps, you can help other people find them by rating them on the App Store or the Google Play Store.
What does a silo of soybeans or an old 1987 Nissan truck have to do with apologetics? When donated, both enabled STR to provide Christians like you with the resources you need to gain confidence in defending your faith. STR's partnership with iDonate makes donating non-cash items easy. You can give personal items like vehicles, stock, jewelry, gift cards, and more. iDonate takes care of selling the items and gives the cash proceeds to STR. So if you're looking for a unique way to support the work of Stand to Reason, consider donating that random gift card Aunt Bertha gave you last Christmas. Simply go to str.org/donate and click the link at the bottom of the page.
All righty, friends. Greg Kokel here back at you, giving you a piece of my mind today, this afternoon, early evening here in Los Angeles. As I do pretty much every Tuesday evening from 4 until 6. And if you'd like to call during that time, Los Angeles time, 855-243-9975. If you're outside of the U.S., of course, you're welcome to call as well. Use your international digit for the U.S. of A and then the area code 562-424-8229. Here with my friend and colleague at Stand to Reason, Jonathan Noyes. Let's go to Sandy in Roseville. And Sandy, you persevere because you hung on so long last time and we never got to you. And I want to thank you for calling back.
Sure. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Sure.
So my question, I wrote it out, so I'll read it to you.
All right.
So I'm attending a small women's Bible study on the book of Jonah, and we're using a study guide written by a popular author and speaker.
Mm-hmm.
And I have two concerns that I wanted to get your thoughts on with regards to the best way that you think I should handle things. And the first is regarding God speaking to us and when we can or can't hear his voice. And I'm familiar with your Solid Ground articles, Does God Whisper? And I agree with your findings.
Mm-hmm.
And I briefly brought that up and recapped the articles in our last session, and I felt like most of the women looked at me in astonishment and disbelief. So that's one thing. And then the second is regarding the overall perspective of the study. The author states in the beginning of the study guide that, quote, our study of Jonah is primarily about helping us to define interruptions when it comes to our relationship with God, is to help you dig deeply into its application into your life, how Jonah's story relates to you, and our goal is reworking our view of God and his plan. So the study appears to be self-focused and heavy on application versus God-centered and God-focused.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm struggling with, do I keep going to the study? Do I talk with the leaders? Like, what is your thought on both of those areas?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm just thinking, maybe John has some things to say about this too, but I'm just thinking about the last point. I'm not troubled with application as long as the application is based on the actual message of the text. And sometimes the tendency is to take biblical texts and make metaphors out of them. You know, so you'll have Jesus calms the storm. And then the question is, what are the storms in your life that Jesus could calm? You know, and that's not the intention of the author, including that particular account in the record, or feeding the loaves and fishes. How God can multiply your efforts, you know, to feed the multitudes. Well, that isn't why Jesus fed the, you know, all that. So that's a concern there. As far as the God speaking to you stuff. It's so ironic because on the one hand, there is this emphasis on hearing the voice of God, apparently, in the community, and then there is this, you know, person-centered approach to the text dealing with Jonah. Personally, I think they're akin to each other because the hearing the voice of God stuff is a way of being, in a certain sense, self-focused. No, I need to mention this for the listeners. I think the general principle not doctrine really, but the general practice, discipline of hearing the voice of God the way it's advanced in most Christian groups is not biblical in the least bit. And so people are distracted by something, learning something that is not a biblical practice, but it is self-satisfying. And I think it's motivated by good things, but I think it creates more kind of a type of narcissism than anything else. I actually am a little reluctant to use that word, but I can't think of another one right now, because I think Christians who hold this view are Christ-minded with it and want to please God, but it turns out to be kind of a focus on me, the same way that the application seems to be. So,
right.
I mean, having said that, let me ask you this. How do they respond to your talking about does God whisper and presenting that idea to the group? That would be unrelated to the Jonah study, right?
Well, no, it was all together because it was talking about, like, Jonah, God interrupted Jonah and asked him to go to Nineveh, and he said no. And so what interruptions do you have in your life that you're ignoring God speaking to you and, apply that to your life in that way?
Uh-huh, I got it. How would they respond to say, wait a minute, isn't there a difference between the office and the way God is working in the life of a bona fide biblical prophet and the way he works in the normal life of Christians? And the particular question has to do with whether we have to get our commands from God in this way.
That's a good point.
Yeah, they don't make that distinction, I guess. Well, I can see how this would all blend together if they are embracing this notion that God speaks to everybody just like he spoke to the prophets in the Old Testament. So what would you say, if you could, in a line or two, is the best way, how would you put your question that we might answer it and bring some help to you?
Well, I guess my bottom line is, should I continue the study? Mm-hmm. Should I go forward to the leaders on the side and say, hey, here's maybe some articles that you might be interested in reading. It's a different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And let them decide to bring it up for the group. Or should I just go and be quiet and go along?
Let me answer this. The first one. I'll have John respond to the second one. He's chuckling over here, so he must have a point of view about this. Because I know John probably wouldn't just go along, but that's John's personality to some degree. But I think it's entirely legitimate to go to the leadership and invite them to look at some other things. But you have to be careful how you do that. You have to go with your hat in your hand, basically, which I suspect you would, politely and not saying, you're wrong on this, I'm right, and this proves that you're wrong,
Right.
Even if they are mistaken, that's since they're in leadership, there's an honor that is due them, and it's a totally appropriate to get other people, even those above you in leadership in a Bible study, to consider an alternate view, and especially if you have something written, like maybe we've done, that you can offer them to think about. Well, then that'll get them thinking, and maybe you can ask them first, would you mind if I offered you something to think about with an idea that you guys actually hold and is assumed in the group? They say, sure, what is it? Then you could talk a little bit about it and offer them that. And if then it's up to them whether they read it or not. I actually wouldn't get my hopes up in a circumstance like this, but I think it's entirely appropriate for you to offer them that to read. Whether or not you stay in the group or not with what you're facing, that's another question. John, do you have a thought on that?
Yeah, I think that this is it's a common, I think the situation that you find yourself in, Sandy, is common, especially within these like women's ministry, men's ministry. Oftentimes, one, I love what Greg just brought up, is that you always come with a attitude of humility to the leadership, but oftentimes the leadership doesn't necessarily know what's being taught in the classes as well. And sometimes the lay leaders who are teaching the classes aren't, I guess, qualified or not educated enough to understand maybe the distinctions that what they're teaching, they don't necessarily understand that. So I think that if you come to the leadership and even the people teaching the class saying, I have kind of not an issue, but the concern that's been raised by this study, would you be willing to look at it for me and maybe meet for coffee and we can discuss it? I would think that if you do it appropriately, graciously, in humility, they'll be thankful for it if they can. Now, is this your home church?
Well, it's not. It started with a church, like we did a study on Romans that was fantastic with a different author. But this group has kind of split off from the church, and so it's not sponsored by the church. It's just a group of women that had been originally with the church group, but now we're just kind of doing our own study. So every time we're doing a different study, and this particular study is the one that's been of concern.
Yeah.
Are all of the studies they've been having before problematic, or is it just this one?
It's just this one.
Okay. Well, that's a good sign. You know, everybody gets a little goofy once in a while, it seems. I guess what I would suggest for you, Sandy, is you have to, as far as whether you stay with the group or not, it sounds like you have enough discernment to see when there's some kind of nonsense going on. And you have to decide whether it's mostly nonsense or if it's some nonsense but some good things too. So if you're getting fed a legitimate meal, you can just maybe ignore the appetizers, you know, eat the meat and throw away the bones kind of thing. But if it turns out to be pretty much all bones as you continue on, maybe it's time to move on. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's good. Some definite good points, and I'll definitely be humble in my approach, so I appreciate your feedback.
All right, Sandy, thank you for your perseverance
you.
And finally get in.
Thank you. Appreciate
All right,
it.
Bye-bye now.
Okay, bye-bye.
Let's go to Ted in San Ramon. That's in California, isn't it, Ted?
Yes, it is, Northern California.
All right, good. Good to have you on board. What's on your
thank
mind?
Thank you.
Sure.
I have maybe a slightly unusual question. Sometimes I get overwhelmed with the abundance of good resources in the apologetic world.
Yeah.
There's so many good resources. Your resources are great, the Story of Reality and the Solid Ground, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. I actually like those immensely.
Do you? That's amazing.
Amazing.
Let me give you two scenarios, and what I'd like you to do is you tell me which resource you would give to this person.
Okay.
It can be a book. It can be a Solid Ground article. Mm-hmm. Anything you want, but I'd like it to be a little smaller and more concise than the average, you know, Francis Schaeffer stuff.
Yeah. Tome.
So, what's that?
Than the average tome, like
right.
heavy, weighty. You
right.
know. Right. Gotcha.
Exactly. So first, we have let's say we have a non-hostile atheist who is seeking and is open to having his mind changed. So he's not hostile, but he is just wanting to have a little nudge.
Mm-hmm.
And what would you give to him?
All right. I'm going to give this to John because John is closer to atheism than I am. I mean, he was an atheist before he became a believer, and then I think you were hostile for a while, and then you kind of mellowed out a little bit. So maybe you have, and you've done a lot of reading in all these areas, so maybe you have some suggestions, especially as something that's not some writer's magnum opus.
Sure. So if you're looking for something that's kind of simple and for the atheist to approach, Josh McDowell's More Than a Carpenter. I gave a copy of that to every member of my family, and I don't know the impact that necessarily had, but it did on me a good one. Also, so I'm going to say this, but I'm going to qualify it. William Lane Craig's On Guard is a really good resource because he boils his reasonable faith down to its essence, and it's really understandable. And for me, when I was struggling at first with Christianity, trying to wrestle through the arguments, I liked it because I was a thoughtful atheist, at least I thought. And it introduced me to why I was wrong in a very clear way, presenting arguments, and I appreciated the book. So On Guard is a fantastic resource. Also, Ambassador's Guide to Atheism is a Stand to Reason resource that's short. I think there's an Ambassador's Guide to Atheism. Isn't yeah, there is, right?
Yeah, there is. Okay.
Alan wrote it. Greg Kokel wrote it.
Oh, I wrote it.
Yeah, it's yours.
Okay.
So, Ambassador's Guide to Atheism is a inexpensive, short resource that I would definitely purchase and give to your friends.
STR.org, right.
That's where I'd get it from.
Yeah, can I recommend also, people have mixed feelings about this, but Lewis's Mere Christianity. And a person can pick it up and read a chapter anywhere and benefit from it, okay? They can read the first segment or section, which is the case for Christianity, which used to be a standalone book, by the way, and just read that part. Or they can read the Christian belief section, which was another standalone. They put it together about 50 years ago. But anyway, that has the quality of a reader paging through it however he wants it, whatever speed he wants, and getting what he wants out of it. Plus, it's hard to beat Lewis for lucid thought and clever writing. So, I mean, I would recommend that.
Well, what about Story of Reality? And I'm not saying that because I'm sitting next to you.
No, I know. I actually wrote it down, too, and I run the risk of, ringing my own bell here. But I do think that is a very accessible book, and it's not – maybe it's larger than you had in mind, Ted, but because you're familiar with it, and so maybe it will be too long for your friend. But it's also, I think, a lot of people told me that they picked it up and started reading it, and then they finished it in one sitting. So it's not that hard to get through. So, I mean, there's a couple of them there that might fit the bill for you.
You're also Greg's story – Greg's Solid Ground, I think – two solid grounds ago was on naturalism, materialism, and that was, I think that's a great, three or four page thing that he could hand off.
Which one is that? What's the title of it?
I forget the title of it. You just wrote it.
Well, is that The Inside Out? No, that isn't.
Before that. Right before that.
Sometime later. Yeah, okay. What do I know?
It was really good.
Well, the solid grounds are good, and you might, Ted, do you have the app for Stand to Reason?
Yes, but I just get it in the old-fashioned mail.
No problem. The reason I mentioned the app, though, is the app usually has the last four or five issues of Solid Ground kind of stacked up there in the app. So it's possible to take a quick reference of that, and that's maybe you find the one that John is talking about. So what was your other question?
Well, the other question, and you might have answered some of it with More Than a Carpenter in the second, but the second is slightly different. This is a person who, for example, is an AA member and Alcoholics Anonymous.
Right.
And gets to the point where they are in the third step, which is they made a decision to turn their will and lives over to the care of God, or as we understand him.
No.
So they're in that helpless, I need God position. And so they're along the journey, they're getting there. The question is, what would then prompt them maybe to think about the next step, which is a relationship with Christ at that point? I hate to use that word. I mean, there's other terms to use. But
no, that's all right. I get what you mean. It's kind of going from G-O-D to a genuine interaction with the God who is actually there.
Right.
Right.
Now, More Than a Carpenter is pretty good, but are there any others?
I'm pausing to think about, what about
the New Believer's New Testament, the one that's edited by Greg Laurie? It's a really good resource. It's the first Bible that was ever given to me, and in it are these bookmarks that really lead you through the basics of the faith. It's a really good resource. The New Believer's Bible, it's a NLT translation, so it's easy to understand. If he's open to reading the Bible, that might not. This is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous who's also an atheist?
No. Again, it's a member of AA who is a true believer in the higher power, quote-unquote.
Right, he's got to that stage. So there is a God, but the way AA leaves it is somewhat amorphous. And so now it is, let's zero down to the real God who can do something for your friend.
Exactly. If it's short and sweet, that's so much the better, I can...
Right, I'm trying to think of short, sweet books. There's one that I read that is still available, I think, and it's simply... it's an account of an atheist becoming a Christian. So it has the basics in it. But because it's Perfect. Narrative, it's easy to follow, and it's not that long. I think it's only – it's not even 150 pages, and it's they're like big print kind of deal. It's not tedious. The book is called Not God's Type.
Oh, that's
not
good.
Not God's Type, and the author is Holly Ordway, O-R-D-W-A-Y. So – That I love that book. It's just so sweet to read. She was a PhD from Amherst, and she in literature, and she was an atheist, pretty aggressive atheist. And then through encounters with her fencing instructor down in San Diego, who turns out was a stand of reason guy, she over a period of about 2 years became a follower of Christ, but had the basic questions. It was knocking around the issues. And so there's some apologetics elements that are worked into the narrative because that was part of her process of becoming a Christian. So I would recommend that, too.
Okay.
So it sounds like you've got a couple of different options there, and that might help either of your friends.
Yeah, Not God's Type, that was the title?
Yeah, Not God's Type, correct.
Holly Ordway.
O-R-D-W-A-Y.
Okay. Correct. Yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, you're so welcome, Ted, and I'm glad you called. Okay, buddy?
All right. Thank you so much. Take care, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, let's take a quick break. Greg Kokel here with Jonathan Noyes for Stand to Reason.
Would you like Greg, Alan, or Tim to come speak at a location near you? If so, just send a quick email to darcy@str.org to schedule them today. Our speakers are accomplished and compelling presenters who address, from a biblical standpoint, topics like abortion, homosexuality, and evolution, as well as apologetics, theology, and evangelism. They're available to teach lectures and seminars, preach sermons, and lead workshops at single events or weekend-long conferences. Their aim is to help Christians like you effectively engage the culture around you with knowledge, wisdom, and character. To learn more, just go to str.org and click on the training tab at the top of the page.
Are you looking for a way to be more involved in the STR community? When you choose to support Stand to Reason with a monthly gift of $10 or more, you become a strategic partner in the work of equipping Christian ambassadors. Your monthly commitment makes you a part of a special group helping STR-trained Christians to graciously defend classical Christianity and classical Christian values. Your monthly gift helps us plan and manage STR's resources and provides consistent support to aid our planning and ongoing work. As a strategic partner, you'll enjoy an automatic 10% discount in our online store, access to a private Facebook group, and bi-monthly insider updates, so you'll get the inside scoop on what's going on in the ministry, and you'll know what you can pray for. Become a strategic partner in the Stand to Reason community today by visiting str.org/donate. Click How Often Will You Donate? And choose Monthly. For personal assistance, you can email ocean@str.org. That's ocean@str.org.
All right, welcome back. Greg Kokel here. John Noyes with me. Stand to Reason. And I am going to be in Cedarville, Ohio at Cedarville University on February 18th. So that's the middle of the month. And that's actually a Tuesday, not a weekend. So I'm going to be doing a number of things there. To be honest, I don't know. It's too far away, you know, for me. I each day has enough cares of its own. But if you want the... actually, there's somebody's email address. That isn't what you want here. Well, I suspect if you go to Cedarville University and check out their calendar, maybe I'll be on there, or go to str.org and to the speakers page, and usually the details for my event are there as well. But I'm doing a conference there and speaking at their chapel, I think. And so anyway, that's February 18th. By the way, do not forget that Rethink is coming up in Texas And we are really thrilled about that. Of course, we have now 5 rethinks a year, and they're in 5 different locations around the country. We're opening up Seattle in the fall. We have Minneapolis there in the fall, too. And so Seattle in October, Minneapolis in November, and Southern California still at Calvary Chapel in September. But our spring rethinks, which is a student apologetics conference targeting young people, particularly middle schoolers and high schoolers, but old timers can come too. And we've been having massive turnouts from 1,500 to 2,500, 2,600, 2,700 at an event, depending on the location. So we are going to be February 28th, Friday, and Saturday, February 29th, at Cottonwood Creek Church. In the Dallas area, North Dallas, right? Is that right? North Dallas. And this is going to be Rethink Your False Ideas About God. I suspect we're pushing about 1,000 already in pre-registrations because I think a week or two we were over 800. And these things just fill up really fast. So my encouragement is for you to go to rethinkapologetics.com for all the information about all of the events. Also in March, we're going to be in Birmingham, Alabama. So that's coming up then, too. So really, what was that? Oh, in April. Oh, really? Okay, thank you. April in Birmingham. Don't have that date right in front of me. But the theme here is rethink your false ideas about God. And, of course, the Stand to Reason team, Greg, Allen, Amy, Tim, John will be there, along with J. Warner Wallace is going to be there in Texas. And I'm trying to think, do you know who else is
there? I don't know who's going to be in Texas.
So we've got a great lineup. It's going to be a super, super conference. We're really thrilled about it. RethinkApologetics.com for all the skinny there. And keep in mind that there is a live stream option for the Texas event. So if you can't make it on Friday night, February 28th, and Saturday, February 29th, you can go to RethinkApologetics.com and arrange for a purchase of the live stream option. I don't know exactly how that works, but you can figure that out, no problem. I'm not the tech guy. Let's see. Well, do I have anything else here? No, I don't. All right, let's go to Tampa, Florida. And Eddie. Hello, Eddie.
Hello, how's it going, Greg?
All righty, you're here with me and John.
Hello?
What's on your mind? Eddie.
Hey, how's it going? I'm sorry, you got cut off for a bit.
No, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, no problem. So, I had a question last week. It was on the... pretty much, I have a lot of conversations with a lot of friends of mine.
Good for you.
And they usually always get to the emotional side of the moral argument.
Hmm.
Okay. I don't know if you know exactly what I mean by that, but elaborate...
You can tell me. I mean, the moral argument is that if there is no God, then there is no objective morality, but there is objective morality. Problem of
Correct.
Evil is an evidence for that, and so there must be a God. And they get emotional
Correct.
About what?
So... they get emotional in the sense that they start moving towards the problem of evil.
Okay.
And so,
okay.
So they start saying, well, regardless, once I make the argument, right, regardless of that, then they say, well, how can a good God still allow X, Y, and Z to happen? Regardless of me already proving the logical side of it,
mm-hmm.
they get too focused on... the evil side of it,
okay.
right? They get really emotional.
Okay, well, sounds to me that something really bad happened in their lives that
yeah.
they would get, you think,
right.
John? Yeah.
Yep.
They get emotionally, understandably, they get emotional about this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering, though, if there's if this approach would be helpful, okay? For one, I think asking them about, you know, what's their stake in this issue to find out and let them talk about it a little bit might be helpful if there was some significant evil that happened in their life. That's always a good idea. Let them talk. Let them voice. Find out what the objection behind the objection is. That makes
okay.
sense? Okay. However, I here's something I've been toying with recently that I think is can be really productive, and that is... okay, I understand, based on what you went through and everything, how you could say, how could God allow such a thing? and you are tempted not to believe in God. I presume that's the circumstance. Is that right, Eddie?
Correct.
Okay, so here's the question then. What is the alternative to belief in God? Well, the alternative to theism is atheism, which is what they're, you know, tempted to think anyway. Okay, now let's just say you adopt, I'm role-playing a little here, you adopt, not you, Eddie, but you, the person, adopt atheism, okay? All of the experiences that you, or the things that you're aware of that are so emotionally difficult for you to countenance and caused you to doubt God, those, all those things are still there, correct?
Correct.
Their experiences are still their experiences. Mm-hmm. The hardship of the world is still the hardship. The unjust suffering is still the unjust suffering. Okay, but the alternative to God is atheism. So now what? As an atheist, what do you make out of those things? And the answer is, you can't, if atheism is true, you can't even call those things evil because it represents, evil represents a violation of some kind of good standard, which standard can't exist in atheism, that you know this issue. So it's maybe touching on the same kind of defense that you suggested earlier that you had maybe covered, but from a different angle. And the angle is, well, wait, that's the alternative. This is all you're stuck with. You're stuck with nothing. You have to say that what happened to you was nothing. It wasn't, it was unpleasant, but it wasn't evil. Does that, and ask them, is that, does that seem like a reasonable alternative? All right. Mm-hmm. Now, I am completely sympathetic with a person who would say, given God, why would God allow this thing? All right. But I'm, but if you, if a person says, I can't imagine a good God would allow this, therefore there's no such thing as a good God, now they're still stuck with the problem of evil and all those awful things. But now what? Now they just have to say it's not evil. It's just the way it is. It's just molecules clashing in the universe. You see that?
Mm-hmm.
And,
okay.
And so it's at this point you're not answering the charge proper. Why would God allow that in my life or in somebody else's life? Partly because it's not possible to answer that charge because we don't know what God was thinking when he allowed certain things to happen. But I will, I will suggest this, a couple of chapters that will help, and a piece that I wrote. Do you happen to have The Story of Reality?
No, I don't.
Well, I I recommend you buy it. I authored it, so I know it's weird for me to say that. But there are two chapters that will help in this regard. And one is simply called Evil. All right? And it's a section, it's a chapter in a section about the fall of man where evil enters the world. The problem of evil actually is, kind of begins. And I talk about this particular problem. How could God be good and powerful and still allow evil in the world? Okay, so that's part of the answer. And the other thing that I talk about, the other chapter I want to recommend is a very short chapter. They're both of them fairly short, but the very short one called In Between. In Between. Okay. And I won't explain what that means, but just try to read that because it does address broadly this question of why did God allow this evil at this time in this place? Like maybe the thing that your friend might be asking.
Right.
We just got about 3 minutes to go, Jim. John, I wanted to give you an opportunity to jump in here and see if you had any thoughts on this.
Yeah, I think what you said is perfect. If you can draw people out and point out somehow also that their emotional response to the suffering and the evil that's in the world kind of proves your case when talking about morality because it shows that there's an objective oughtness out there. So the very fact that they're sad or feeling down or they feel like they have all this evil in the world shows the fact that there is an objective standard. Things aren't as they ought to be. So if you're able to point that out, just like what Greg said, I think that that for me has gone a long way in my conversations. Not trying to address the problem, solve the problem for them. We can't do that. but showing them that the very fact that we have these reactions to these evil things, there is a morality that's out there, independent of us.
So, in a sense, Eddie, there's two things here. Does the problem of evil disprove God? And you know, and one of the things we're emphasizing is it actually does just the opposite. It proves God. Because if you get rid of God, there can't be any problem of evil. Mm-hmm. And the person who suffered the evil has got to say, well, that was just a bunch of nothing. That's all that's left to them, right? But then given God, what the person is, then you've got another issue. Then the question is, well, okay, I believe there has to be a God, but how could that God be good if he allows this kind of thing? And this is where I think the chapters I recommended, the chapter on evil in particular, where we show that it is entirely possible, plausible, let me put it that way, it's entirely plausible that a good and powerful God could allow evil for a season or for a reason, let's put it that way. And simply put, he could allow evil if there is a greater evil that it prevents, that this evil prevents a greater evil, or that this evil establishes a greater good, okay? So that the equation works out better because God allowed evil in a certain situation. Now, I give some examples of that to show how this is entirely plausible. And because it's entirely plausible, this is why, and again, something you're aware of, the deductive problem of evil doesn't go through. It is possible to think of reasons that God, a good God, a powerful God, would allow evil. And then the other one is the much more personal issue, and that's why I directed you to the other chapter, which is in between. And my point is we're in between the fall and the resolution of the fall at the end of all things as God makes right everything. And then we have the answering the question of why did God allow this person to die or suffer at this moment in this place? These are questions we can't answer because we don't know the mind of God on those. So I just recommend those to you. Will that help, do you think, Eddie?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, just hearing you even just, you know, speak out on that side, at the end of it, I actually gives me a different perspective on how to approach it.
Uh-huh.
Because I'm usually the one doing most of the, you know, the talking in a way.
Yeah.
So I can't really put myself in the opposite end.
Sure, sure.
But hearing you say it definitely gives me that perspective.
Okay, that sounds good. Eddie, got to run. There's our music. Thank you so much for the call. Greg Kolka with Jonathan Noyes. John, thanks for being part of our show.
Thank you for having me. It's fun.
Yeah, it was. All right, that's it, friends. Greg Kolka for Stand to Reason. Give him heaven. Bye-bye now.